Welcome to Daily Kos's The Brief, our weekly show about politics. Here, we'll discuss the issues that are driving the news as we fight for a more progressive America. I am Marcos Omolitsis, the founder of Daily Kos and your co-host, along with senior political writer Carrie Elleveld. If you want to join the conversation, we record the podcast live on YouTube and Facebook every Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. Enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Daily Kos The Brief with me, Marcos Omolitsis, and Carrie Elleveld. We have a great show for you today. We have our first repeat guest, Eli Mistel. He writes for The Nation. He writes about legal affairs. We're going to be talking impeachment, the impeachment vote, and what that portends for the Republican Party. He's a character. You're going to love him. We also have Sarah Longwell. She is a prominent Never Trumper, among other things. She was the founder of Republican Voters Against Trump. And we're going to be talking with her about the future of her party. Clearly, she's not a happy camper right now, and we'll explore what, if anything, sane Republicans can do to try to bring back their party from the brink. So we have a great show for you today. Carrie, this is really, we're still in the midst of the aftershocks of the impeachment vote. And I think Republicans want to pretend that it's over and it's behind them. And can we just please talk about marginal tax rates or whatever it is they want to talk about. But this is a real issue. They are in disarray, to put it mildly. And there are aftershocks to that vote that won't be dissipating anytime soon, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, I think, you know, I heard this, the question being framed is it going to be more important that he was acquitted, or is it going to be more important that seven Republicans joined Democrats in voting to convict? And I am definitely in the latter camp, right? I mean, yes, it would have been nice if he had actually been convicted and then just they could have disqualified him from holding office. That would have had a huge impact, but that was never going to happen with this Republican Party. There just aren't enough inspired spine, you know, people with spines in the Republican Party right now to make that happen. So the fact that that the trial even drew seven Republican votes, though, portends a huge civil war on the horizon. And then, you know, Mitch McConnell, of course, he tried to split the baby by, you know, acquitting, but then going to the floor and making that, you know, speech that it was a real indictment of Trump. He really ripped into Trump.
And you're right. And you made this great point that McConnell could have led. And the fact is that he actually followed his party. And that abdication of leadership is just another sign that Republicans are, you can either say they're leaderless or they're sort of trapped in this sort of orbit of Trumpism and they can't escape it.
Right. I mean, McConnell didn't, let's face this, McConnell didn't have the political juice to get his caucus to vote the way he probably thought it should have voted. And so, you know, whatever the factors are that play into that, he didn't have the political juice to do it. So instead, he followed his caucus and voted to acquit and then went on the floor and tore Trump a new one, right? And now he's, he's going to try and keep those corporate donors satisfied, but and you know, also, you know, try to keep some semblance of a GOP that isn't just a cult of personality. He came back, I think, yesterday and wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed saying that Trump was morally responsible. You know, I think the headline was something like the Constitution, the acquittal vote or something was good for the Constitution, but not good for Trump or something like that. I mean, you know, it's like, really? Come on.
And right. And the reason he was conflicted is, I mean, there's two reasons, I think. One is obviously he doesn't like Trump, right? I mean, it was clear that Trump made his life miserable for 4 years. They had the presidency and the only thing they accomplished legislatively was tax cuts for billionaires. And not that McConnell is sad about that, but I'm sure there's
a proud legacy for McConnell. Proud.
I'm sure there's a lot more he would have been able to do had he had an actual competent, had it been Mike Pence. I think the damage would have been a lot worse. Much of the damage that Trump did, we can actually reverse by executive order because it was done by executive order or by federal agencies, sort of, you know, their priorities and things like that. There isn't a lot of legislation for us to fight back on or to try to reverse, which makes our jobs easier in cleaning house of the sort of Trump effect. I'm sure McConnell would have loved to codify a lot of that a lot of that damage into law, and he wasn't able to do so. But also the damage that Trump did to the Republican Party is pretty obvious. They lost control of the House. They lost control of the Senate. They lost the White House, only the third president in 100 years to lose a re-election battle. So it is quite the accomplishment. And not only did he lose the present for the Republican Party, but he seriously damaged the Republicans moving forward by costing the party crucial support with college-educated white people in the suburbs, predominantly women. So right. There's a lot for them to have to deal with. So I know McConnell doesn't like him. And then, of course, the same Donald Trump then tries an insurrection, which I don't think, maybe Josh Haley and Ted Cruz were into that, but I don't think most Republicans were really into insurrection.
I have to say, I just feel like this was such a layup for them at that moment to make the break. You know, they'd gone ahead and backed his whole, like, you know, the election was stolen from me crap for, you know, weeks, for more than a month, right?
And they either backed it or they said nothing because they hoped it would peter out.
But that insurrection moment was a moment where you say, hey, you know what? The commander in chief of the United States shouldn't launch an attack on the national seat of government, right? I mean, this is such a basic concept, and it was such an easy thing for them at that point to make that break, and they still failed. McConnell failed, Kevin McCarthy failed, Mike Pence wouldn't even stand up for himself and his family after it became clear that Trump had targeted him and, you know, and didn't really give a, you know, whatever's well, I didn't really give a rat's, you know what I want to say, right?
You can say rat's ass. Well, this is not a family show.
It's family friendly. My daughter watches it every, no, she doesn't. She wouldn't understand it. But anyway, so, I mean, you know, but like this should have been a layup for them. And they still couldn't manage to do it just because there aren't enough inspired Republicans who care enough about the country, who have enough of a spine, who have enough self-respect to think for themselves, you know, to do what needed to be done. And I will say, let me just add this. On top of all these things we know, right, there's also this other slew of data coming out that shows that, number one, people are the high, Gallup just showed the highest support ever it's seen since polling this in the early 2000s for a third party to arise. So 62% of Americans now say that the two-party system isn't doing it and we need a third party. That's an all-time high for that. And the GOP's image, the Republican Party's image is down to like, I think 37% in Gallup, which isn't an all-time low, but it's pretty low and it's dropped like at least a handful of points since November. So, you know, there's, and Democrats are going up in that poll. So the Republican Party, it's not like just theoretical here. There is a serious rift within that party, a serious rift. And McConnell and Trump are set to duke it out now. I mean, McConnell, by publishing that Wall Street Journal op-ed, and, you know, they're going to be in a battle over whether or not reasonable Republicans make it through the primary in 2022 to run in the general.
Yeah. And, you know, McConnell could have actually cut that in the book. You know, he could have voted to convict and then he would have just immediately ripped out that Trump cancer. And yeah, Trump Jr. is going to hang around, but I don't think Trump Jr. has the juice that his father does. And he'll be deplatformed anyway before long because he's going to try to do the same playbook. And so you have donors and their donors are saying we can't. Corporate donors are saying we can't give to a Republican Party that has sort of gone into league with racists and white nationalists and Nazis. And that was the big wild card, I thought. You know, if McConnell thinks that he won't be able to raise the money, he may have no choice. That might be the thing that pushes him to vote to convict. And if he voted to convict, he might have brought another nine Republicans with him for sure.
Well, he certainly couldn't. Yeah. Oh, look, our primary guest is here, our first guest.
Okay, this is great. So let's bring him in. He is Elie Mistal. He is a writer for The Nation, and he is one of our favorite guests we've ever had, and our first repeat guest. And there's a reason for that. You're gonna I think you will love him very much. Elie, it's such a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You look great, Elie. You look great. I like that.
I didn't. I've been writing all day, so I didn't see what my hair was doing until just now.
I do the same thing before I go on. But this is now a podcast too, so don't worry. Probably most people that are listening to this won't know that your hair isn't prop. Your hair is fine. I don't know what you're complaining about. It is actually perfect. I don't even know what we're talking about. So, Elie, this is the biggest, most broad question I can possibly ask. But, like, what's your main takeaway from the vote to acquit Donald Trump in the on Saturday in the impeachment trial in the Senate?
I mean, the broadest take is whites win again, right? Like, this is the attempt to hold white people accountable for their crimes is hard. It's just not something that we as a nation have a habit of doing, holding, you know, powerful, you know, poor white people, sometimes we can do it, right? But rich and powerful white people, we just don't do that as a nation. And this was yet another example of it. You know, kind of unpacking a little bit more, you know, the Senate was cowardly in a way that we, I think, all expected them to be. They themselves are complicit in the insurrection, right? And that's something that I think was lost a little bit during the House managers, generally, you know, great and legally really strong.
They were trying to get some votes. I mean, there was an actual effort, right? As opposed to just score cheap political points, because they could have done that and embarrassed most of the Senate caucus, the Republican caucus.
And I would have been down for the embarrassment, frankly. But yeah, they were trying to convince Republicans to come onto their side. And by trying to convince Republicans, that means you can't call them out for their complicity in the violence. So for instance, I thought a great example of this, and I wrote about this in The Nation, was, you know, the House managers made a big deal of that campaign issue where the Biden-Harris bus was going down the road in Texas, and then a bunch of MAGA people tried to, like, push it off the road, drive it off the road. They made a big deal about how Trump, you know, supported that and encouraged that. And they, you know, tweeted it out with a little soundtrack to show that his violence wasn't just on January 6th, that he was inciting this from long before. And that's a great point, except that, you know who else encouraged that violence? Marco Rubio. Yeah. The weekend after that bus was almost run off the road, Marco Rubio had a rally in Florida, and he said, "Did you see what they did in Texas? We love those people." Marco Rubio, of all people, did the exact same thing. So how do you really turn around if you're Marco Rubio and, you know, convict Trump of doing what you yourself did? Republicans in the Senate, this is the last thing I'll say about this, the Republicans in the Senate did everything that Trump did except try to kill Mike Pence. Like that was the special sauce that Trump
it was a low bar, and they managed to clear it. It was a really low bar. They didn't try to kill the vice president, and, you know, pat on the back for that, right?
Right. That's the operative distinction between Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump, whether or not they think Mike Pence should live.
Right. Right. So and basically, I think, you know, every one of the Republicans who ultimately voted to convict was a person who at some point actually admitted that Joe Biden really won the election and stopped pushing that lie. Even, you know, Bill Cassidy belatedly admitted that Joe Biden won. So they weren't going to pick up, I think, to your point. They weren't going to pick up any of those Republicans because they'd all engaged in the same behavior, the exact same behavior, with the exception of the seven who voted to convict.
The Trump lawyers at impeachment couldn't admit that Biden won the election. Like they still feel the need to cast doubt on the results of the election, even after they've seen the harm and the damage that it's caused.
Like, I mean, that was the reason, you know, Trump had like the D team of lawyers, right? Because the A and B teams wanted nothing to do with him. The C team got fired the week before the election because they didn't want to agree to pretend that Biden wasn't the president. So then you've lost
Alan Dershowitz, right?
And so this is one of the reasons I wish Democrats had called witnesses because that legal team was ready to just implode on itself. And it would have been, if nothing else, it would have been hilarious.
Do you have any insights as to why, I mean, as to the story behind why they ultimately didn't call witnesses? And I do wonder if there was some intimidation of witnesses that ended up happening between the night before this thing about the Kevin McCarthy phone call with Trump, where, you know, Trump said, well, I guess these insurrectionists are a little bit more, a little bit more angry about the, you know, election than you are. And then Kevin McCarthy said reportedly, you know, I don't who the F do you think you're talking to? Right. I mean, that was the conversation that was reported. And when that blew up the night before the impeachment closing arguments were about to come, then it seemed like the next morning there might actually be witnesses. And of course, there was that vote for witnesses. But I wonder, like, what happened in that negotiation that they ultimately decided not to call witnesses? Was it Democrats backing off? Was it a drying up of witnesses, et cetera?
I mean, my insight is that I'm a Mets fan and I'm used to my team losing in embarrassing ways. Like that's what happens. There are legitimate legal-ish arguments for why you don't call witnesses at that stage of the proceedings. One, I think the best argument has been made by Dan Goldman, who was one of the House impeachment lawyers for impeachment one. And maybe he'll be back for impeachment three. We don't know. was that you can't throw a witness on the stand that you haven't deposed, that you haven't researched, that you haven't vetted. Like, that all needs to happen and that takes time. And so, you know, you couldn't just, you know, point to the gallery and say, you come over here and talk, unless you were willing to delay it for some, you know, for some amount of time, a week, let's say, to at least do some basic legal work. Dan Goldman is absolutely right about that. You don't call cold witnesses. And there's a good reason for that. My quibble, my issue with that is that, well, that's why you prepare during all the time before the start trial. That's why you prep some witnesses, just in case you might have an opportunity to call some, just in case you might need some. That's why you do the prep work beforehand, A, and then B, if it's going to take an extra week, you take the extra week because the man attacked the Capitol. Like the Chris Coons story in Political, I have to get home for Valentine's Day. Like that's an unacceptable answer to me, right?
Yeah, that's just a big dereliction of duty as Republicans voting against conviction. It's a sense that this isn't as important because X.
I'm going to try to give Chris Coons the benefit of the doubt that he was making some kind of horribly inappropriate joke, as opposed to actually is just Chris Casanova Coons that really needed his special Valentine's Day, whatever. I'm going to give him that much credit, right? But this question of witnesses, I mean, look, it's not the most important thing, but it is a little mark of intellectual consistency. You didn't have a show then, but I would have come on your show during impeachment one. I spent a whole bunch of time talking about how you can't have a real trial with witnesses. I believed it then. I happen to believe the same thing through two impeachment trials, right? I wanted witnesses for impeachment one. That means, of course, I wanted witnesses for impeachment two. And this whole issue about, like, oh, well, the subpoena process, maybe Kevin McCarthy, this is what you were saying, Carrie, maybe some of the witnesses wouldn't have testified freely. Okay, well, then your solution to that is not to spend a year or 2 years, or I think we're on 3 years to get Don McGahn. It's not to subpoena Kevin McCarthy if he's unwilling. It is to put the people on the stand who already are willing and aren't going to fight you because they have valuable live testimony to give. You know, one of my moments was frustration was actually after the trial was over when the whole Senate, like, they clasped hands and sang Kumbaya and gave a medal to Eugene Goodman, a man certainly deserving of a medal. But instead of giving a medal, put him on the stand. Let him tell you what he saw. Let him tell you what they called him while he was saving your lives. Does that change Republican mind? No, you're never changing Lindsey Graham's mind. Lindsey Graham doesn't have a mind. He has fear. And he just lives in that. He's not a logical person, right? But Eugene Goodman, who they all owe their lives to, who many of them owe their lives to, telling him what those people were calling him would have been powerful testimony. There is not a prosecutor on this earth, and I'm anti-prosecutor generally. There is not a prosecutor on this earth that goes with written testimony or video evidence over live witness testimony if they have that option.
Yeah, I mean, that's inexplicable, and I will never understand it. And I still haven't seen a good reason why that never happened. I mean, there's a really good argument that this trial was less about trying to get a conviction because Republicans were just not going to offer their 17 votes, and more about sort of building that narrative for history. And I actually did think on that mark that the trial was actually pretty good. It just laid out the case from beginning to end, and Trump's sort of key role in it. Unfortunately, like you say, it omitted the role of Senate Republicans and even House Republicans in fueling that as well. But at least it sort of put it all on Donald Trump in a way that I think the general public, anybody who was paying attention or even the media covering it, could sort of create this really easy narrative about what happened, as opposed to trying to piece together 3 months of news reports. And yeah. I mean, there was stuff that came out there that I'd forgotten, right? Because we're so bombarded by the craziness of the entire Trump years, right? The exhaustion, but just even the last 3 months was like amped up even further. So it was nice having that sort of package storyline.
I really do think one of the best things they did, and they did it from the very first moment, from the very first video montage they put together in Jamie Raskin's opening arguments, right, is showing the action and reaction of Trump, the action of Trump saying something, and then the reaction among his cultists, you know, whether it be, we're going to go to the Capitol, and then, yep, we're going to go to the Capitol, and it's that way, you know, to Mike. I hope Mike Pence has the courage to do the right thing. Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do the right thing. He betrayed you, you know, and then you can hear it on the loudspeaker, you know, someone actually like belting out Trump's tweet just after it's sent, and everyone saying, traitor Pence. I mean, you know, the action and reaction was really, really stunning in ways that, and clarifying in ways that you kind of knew, but just hadn't been so obvious.
I thought the most compelling piece was this issue of this Trump tweet about Pence after Trump was informed that Pence had been taken to security, gotten by security, right? Like I paid attention, right? I hadn't linked up that the Tuberville call that was widely reported happens just before he sends that tweet. And now we can, if you're a Republican, you can go, well, did he really? Of course he knew. Of course he knew at the point where he was calling Tuberville. And Tuberville's like, I'm being moved. Of course, at that point, Trump knows that Mike Pence is in danger. And then he sends the Mike Pence betrayed you tweet. That's that. If this was a legal case, that's game over. That is ball game. Which is why, you know, when people are just like, oh, well, should we prosecute him criminally? Look, the standard for criminal liability for inciting speech to riot is hard to meet. It's supposed to be hard to meet. We would have a bad country if it was easy. Oh, sorry, a worse country if it was easier. To me, that's
every Black Lives Matter protester would be in jail right now. If that was the standard.
Exactly. That said, that was a pretty good legal definition of incitement that the House managers laid out. He knew what he was doing was likely to cause violence. He knew that there was an imminent danger when he was doing it, and his words, his speech, directly led to that violence. That makes the Brandenburg test, at least to my mind, it's certainly a colorable case. And that's really where the next phase of this goes. By failing in their duty, the Republican Senate has put this back on to law enforcement, and specifically Joe Biden's Justice Department, to pick up the ball. I don't know what Merrick Garland will do, assuming that Merrick Garland gets a hearing this time. I guess.
The DC prosecutors are looking into that incitement possibility, correct? And maybe you can describe really quickly what the Brandenburg test is, because I'm sure most people don't know.
Yeah, so the Brandenburg test is just, put like this. Most of the things that we say are protected speech, right? The Brandenburg test is a test designed, it comes from a Supreme Court case, Brandenburg v. Ohio, designed to figure out when your speech is not protected. Right. So I can say everything. I can say like, yeah, we got to go get that guy. We got to fight like hell to kill him. Wait, whoa. That's over the line. Right. So what's the difference between fight like hell and kill him. The Brandenburg test is supposed to help us understand what that difference is. And the Brandenburg test has three prongs. One prong is that the speech has to be kind of directly, explicitly or implicitly a call for violence. So both kill him and I wish he was dead would
right? Yeah.
The second thing is that it has to be an imminent harm. So like if I say this on Tuesday and then somebody dies on Friday, I should be okay. But if I say this at 5 o'clock on Tuesday and somebody takes my words and goes kill somebody at 6 o'clock on Tuesday, that's kind of the imminent threat, right? And it has right. to actually cause the harm, right? You can't.
Can I just jump in? I think we have kind of time for at least one last question. And, you know, I think because to your point earlier, I think Mitch McConnell was all too happy to jam the Biden administration with having to figure out what to do about potentially looking into this as a, you know, as a criminal case. Right. And I mean, I think if I'm right, in the Wall Street Journal op-ed that McConnell authored, he basically, you know, he pushed that it's now a criminal matter. Right. So my question is do you think, given what you know about Merrick Garland, how aggressive do you think he's going to be? And I'm assuming that he's going to get that, you know, he's going to get confirmed, which, as you said, maybe that's a little bit of an assumption. But what do you think about Merrick Garland as heading a Justice Department with not only this, you know, this situation, but also so much that has to happen in terms of racial justice reform and things like that? So I just wonder what you have, whether you have any faith in Merrick Garland or not. I don't know.
Why you gotta ask me that, Carrie? I don't.
I'm not trying to jam you. I really figure you have a better idea of what Merrick Garland.
I was hoping for a little more enthusiasm. It was going to give me hope, but I'm not getting the hope from your.
I want to give the man a chance. I want to give the man a chance. His record as a judge does not give me hope. Merrick Garland as a judge was beyond centrist. He was very pro law enforcement. He was very pro police, which in the context of our country, that means he was very anti reforms, holding police accountable, holding authority accountable for their crimes. And that does not give me a lot of hope that he is now going to turn around and hold a bunch of authority figures accountable. On the other hand, that's how he was as a judge. As a prosecutor, we know that he is one of the big guys that, you know, he is largely responsible for bringing Timothy McVeigh to justice, right? So he literally has a track record of prosecuting white domestic terrorists, which is who we have in our country that we most desperately need to deal with, right? So I want to give him a chance. I want to hope that he's going to act more like Prosecutor Garland and less like Judge Garland and actually go after these people specifically. And this, I've said this a couple times around the media, and I increasingly feel like I'm on a very small hill here, but reports say that 800 people stormed the Capitol. Only about 200 people have been arrested or charged with crime. That leaves 600 criminals on the loose. Every single person who breached the Capitol should be charged with the very least felony trespass and felony disorderly conduct. That's the floor for all of this. Everybody who charged the Capitol, everybody who breached the Capitol must be brought to justice. Now, if you bring all those people to justice, those are not all super serious crimes. But, you know, some of these people who are used to having, you know, organic fed meals from their mama, maybe with the specter of 3 months in the pokey, maybe they will flip on some of the other organizers and help. And that's how you start building the more serious cases, by turning some of these low-level people into cooperating witnesses as opposed to free at large.
Right.
So at the very least, Garland's Justice Department has to go out and get the extra 600 people that so far Chris Wray has decided in his infinite wisdom to let walk free. And then we can start talking about the larger prosecutions.
Right. Ellie, we have time for one more question, so let me squeeze this in. Of all the sort of cases that you're seeing, you know, building against Donald Trump, both criminal, like stuff down in Georgia, civil cases in New York, do you see any of them that have a real good chance of actually convicting or going against Donald Trump in a way that would make us feel good as liberals? Because we want justice, and clearly Republicans won't allow that in D.C. But is there other ways that we might get that justice we all crave so much?
Jail is hard. Jail is hard. I can even see him losing criminal cases that would carry jail time if it was like his third offense, but like wouldn't because it's his first offense. And just jailing a president just logistically is hard, right? Like he would have, like, as far as I read the statute, Trump is still entitled to Secret Service protection for the rest of his life. So do you have like a separate cell for the Secret Service while he's in actual physical jail? Is I want it, I still hope for it, but it's hard to see. In terms of like having legal judgments go against him, even in criminal cases, the E.G. Carroll case is still hanging out there, and you know, she's got evidence, and she's still waiting for her DNA
that's
sample.
That's the rape.
It's a defamation case. Yeah, it's related to the rape, but it's defamation case.
So that's serious. That's still going on. This new one that was filed today by Benny Thompson, chairman of the Homeland Security team with the NAACP. I just wrote that up for The Nation. It should be publishing tomorrow. Like that's a great case where they're charging him under the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act for civil liability for basically inciting a riot to stop a government official from doing their duties. I think that has a lot of legs. That suit is against Trump and Giuliani, and that's another thing. That's how I'll end it, to make liberals feel better. I don't know if ultimate responsibility will come to Trump, but some of these people that have been enabling him for 4 years, especially people like Rudy Giuliani, one of the things that Trump has shown us is that while he might be Teflon, people around him ain't. And
And he might try to have you killed in the end. So there you go.
wait, what?
Well, I mean, he tried to have
Pence killed. He just won't pay you. I don't think he's going to.
He literally tried to have Pence killed.
Giuliani needs to email Snowden and see if there's any room in the bunker or whatever. Because like that's where he's going to need to go to escape justice.
Ellie Vistal, you can catch his writing at The Nation. And I definitely can't wait to read this this new article posting tomorrow on this new case that's filed against them.
What's your Twitter handle,
Ellie? At LENYC, ELIENYC.
Ellie, thanks so much for joining us.
Made the handle before I had children. I thought I was going to live there forever.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, Carrie, I just got these new AirPods, and they keep popping out. So,
Do you have them in the right? Do you have them in the right ones?
Yeah. I think I just got the wrong sort of nozzle in there. You know, you can swap out the nozzles. That's what I get for not testing them out before we go live. So I'm crushed at the idea that maybe Trump being in jail is.
I'm just crushed. I'm crushed that, you know, I hear a lot of people have spent a lot of time when you consider Merrick Garland thinking about his prosecutorial experience and liberals sort of emphasizing, you know, some of his wins in that department in terms of like, well, maybe he'll be really aggressive. But, you know, hearing Ellie talk about what he was like as a judge, and I mean, just.
There was a reason that Obama picked him for the Supreme Court, because he thought that given that sort of record, it would grease his skids through a Republican Senate.
I am fully aware of that.
Given Obama's situation, I understand that. Given Biden's one, and he's been so good on almost everything, so that one's a little disappointing. But he may surprise.
Biden himself has surprised. That is true. Merrick Garland was not my first pick as an AG. But what do I know? And, you know, I thought Biden clearly wasn't my first pick either as the standard bearer of the Democratic Party. And guess what? I'm pretty pleasantly surprised so far. So, you know.
So, Carrie, do you want to introduce our next guest?
Yes, absolutely. So now we're going to talk the future of the Republican Party with someone who thinks about that basically 24/7. I've noticed that she's done within the last like 24 hours, a handful of interviews on this. Her name is Sarah Longwell. I knew her back in D.C. and she was part of one of my friend groups that was like 30 Democrats and Sarah Longwell. She's a never Trump Republican. She's got a lot of different hats that she puts on. She's founder of the Republican Accountability Project, Republican Voters Against Trump. You may remember some of these testimonials, that these kind of raw, unedited testimonials that came out. Those were put together by Republican Voters Against Trump, and also now publisher of The Bulwark. So anyway, without further ado, Sarah Longwell, welcome to The Brief. Uh-oh, we lost her. We lost Sarah.
We have Walter, our producer, I think, probably troubleshooting there right now.
I don't know if we're ever going to get Sarah. Anyway, we'll have her on another time because she's a good person to talk on this topic. But I have been fascinated. So I'll just, you know, launch into the topic of this. I've been a little fascinated lately with the idea of whether or not the conditions are right for there to be a third party. And I know this is something, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, everybody back in the Obama era predicted that the Republicans were going down the tubes and they were going to go off a demographic cliff and whatever. And, you know, I understand that, you know, I think those predictions were a little early, but I do think there's something really interesting about there being first of all, after going through 4 years of Trump and the Republican Party having a moment when they could have broken away from them and didn't manage to do so, and how many people there are, what even if it's a smaller slice of the Republican of conservative voters, how many people there are who really don't want, you know, Donald Trump to be the standard bearer of their party. So, for instance, let me just put some numbers to this. Politico Morning Consult poll today showed that 57%, which is going to, you know, I mean, this is just going to floor progressives, right? 57% of conservative voters said that they wanted Trump to play a major role in the party, right? So everybody was like, wow, 57%, that's really high. But 17% said that they wanted him to play a minor role, and 18% said they didn't want him to play a role at all. So if you think about that, that 18% who didn't want Trump to play a role at all, That is a solid slice of disaffected voters as we're watching Trump continue to be the dominant force of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically a fifth of their party, and they are not functional. They cannot win nationally with that kind of erosion. But that also points to the difficulty in a third party, which would split the right. I mean, it might be great for us as liberal Democrats, but they would really be, what you'd see is they'd be out in the wilderness for a while, which on the other hand, they might be anyway, because right. Because the problem they have is that they got all these new voters, and you know, in Georgia alone, Trump won by 5 points in 2016, and then he got 360,000 more votes, which is 18% more voters. The challenge at that point becomes, how do you, you know, you're in the wilderness. If you don't have, if you keep these Trump voters, because there's so many of them, but you're in the right. wilderness because you lost young people, and you're motivating young people to keep turning out. You lost suburban voters and so on, right? Demographically, you may have more votes, but you activated a much larger group of voters against you.
Well,
or yes, you sort of like rip off the Band-Aid and you're still in the wilderness, but at least you're building towards something, because those Trump right. voters, they're mostly old, they're rural, and they're dying, quite simply. They're not the future of anything, and they're not growing with the people that are actually growth demographics.
And I don't see how it helps them. So I am more interested in this idea of a third party, very much in a short-term manner. In other words, like, could they put up, you know, could someone like Adam Kinzinger be put up for, you know, to run on a third party ticket in 2024? I don't know about the long-term implications and whether or not, you know, we would reshape the whole American political system with a third party. That's a much bigger consideration. But in the short term, I think the support for a third party is notable. And I feel like the basics are there for it. Number one, the GOP's image is plummeting. Number two, there's support for this. There's more support than ever for a third party. Number three, tens of thousands of voters are changing. A unique number of voters are changing their affiliation away from being Republicans. And number four, you've got a bunch of former GOP officials who know both the governance side and the political side, the electoral side of running a party, right? So you have voters, You have potentially corporate donors, people to pony up money, and you have GOP, former GOP officials who actually know something about governance, know something about running political campaigns. And it, that to me suggests you have the ingredients. 2016, sometimes people talked about this and it felt like it was an escape hatch that didn't have any of the grounding that was necessary. And now it feels to me like there actually are the elements and the makings of this.
I mean, one thing I think we could put to bed is the idea of Trump starting a third party. I mean,
no, that's not happening.
And I think they finally realized it. But a lot of the people who want a third party
said the problem with starting a third party for Trump is that it actually takes work.
And right. This is a guy who bankrupted a casino, which is a business that literally prints its own money. You think he's actually going to do anything that isn't run by that D-list, because nobody worth anything. So are you going to have a Jared Kushner? Are you going to have a Steve Bannon running this thing? I mean, he doesn't have people who know how to run things around him. And second of all, it would descend. I mean, maybe it'd be great because it would be the biggest grift and it would suck all that MAGA money into Donald Trump's pocket.
But on top of that, you know, I do think that this situation from the insurrection has really opened up something, a gaping wound in the Republican Party that cannot be fixed. I mean, they cannot paper over this.
Yeah, for sure. I think Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley Haley, I think they're done, right? I don't see how they recover nationally from their involvement in the insurrection. Then you have people like Ben Sasse of Nebraska, right? Who mm-hmm. clearly has presidential ambitions, and even Nikki Haley, who have distanced themselves from Trump, and they look like they're hanging out on a limb right now, given that their party is still mostly supportive of Trump. But they're sort of making this bet. I think, particularly with after what you said, that people seeing the insurrection may start to rethink this. And you definitely see more and more stories of people abandoning Q and realizing it was all BS. And so that's a narrative that's growing. And maybe they think in 4 years, things will have flipped around. And maybe people hate Biden enough that they'll be looking for tax cuts, I guess. Because, I mean, what else is Nikki Haley and Ben Sasse going to run on? Tax cuts and abortion, I guess. Tax cuts and abortion.
No matter what, though. I mean, look, this is going to be this next decade politically is going to be very tumultuous for all of us, for all Americans, right? But no matter what, regardless of what a Ben Sasse might think he's running on, or a Nikki Haley might think she's running on, or anybody else, for the next 4 years for the Republican Party, this is where the fight's going to be. I mean, Trump is going to be trying to, he's going to want a litmus test for everybody who wins a GOP primary. And McConnell, because McConnell, all he cares about it. They both only care about power, really. McConnell, all he cares about is power. And he's going to spend his time trying to make sure that there are electable Republicans in these Senate races. And that's a head-to-head collision between McConnell and Trump, one way or the other.
So we have a question from Greg on YouTube, and he asks, kind of in the theme of what we're talking about, if there is a third party, do you think it would be more likely to be a Trumpist party or an anti-Trump party? And that really is sort of the question. If it's Trump himself isn't going to start a party, but there could be a very Trumpian type of party. And in fact, that might even make more sense, because anything with Trump directly associated will be a grift.
Who would put it together?
That's a good question. I mean, yes. Steve Bannon. I don't know.
Maybe, but I just Rifters. Don't think there's the third party is going to be. You know, I mean, Trump doesn't. He hijacked a party, and now that party is his. And there's no reason for him to go to the trouble of trying to remake a party when McConnell and McCarthy just handed that party to him. They just handed that party to him. So there's no reason for him to do that. He is the party now. The only way I really believe, and I think this is a sincere question and a good question, but I am personally convinced that the only third party arises out of Never Trumpers at this point. Those are the only people who are disaffected enough at this point to decide we're gonna and to have the wherewithal. the new donor, a fresh donor base, the people who know how to do it, the people who know how to form a political party and run a political party. I think that's the only place it can come from.
Yeah, and that's the only party that can actually viably grow its support. I mean, maybe it could start clawing back some of those suburban college-educated white women by not being terrifyingly scary and dismissive of democracy and, you know, bullies and the things that drove them away. I mean, those voters aren't locked in for the Democrats by any means. And so, again, they would have to be out in the wilderness. I mean, there's just no, I don't see a scenario where Republicans aren't out in the wilderness absent. And this is my big, you know, obviously my big fear is that our side gets complacent and decides to sit things out. And that's why I was so heartened by the Georgia runoff elections, because we actually did better in that turnout election, turnout wise, than Republicans did. So I'm hoping that we stay engaged and realize that we can't do what we did in 2010 with Barack Obama and just walk away and let Republicans take control of everything again in Congress and state legislatures, because we're still suffering the consequences of that decision to sit that one out. Broadly speaking, obviously you and me didn't sit that out, but no. Broadly speaking,
I meant to get the vote to the voting booth and just, you know.
So we have a question from Maisie Azaz. Maisie Atas, she asked why so many people still voted for Trump. It's after 4 years of watching him do whatever it is that Trump did for 4 years. And that is to me the final, you know, the ultimate question. And it really comes down to racism. I mean, he really brought people out that were disaffected, disenchanted with society in general. I mean, these are all white, mostly rural people who are cut out of the modern economy. Their factories have been shut down and shipped overseas. They live in dying towns where all the young people have sort of left for hipper, cool, you know, cooler places like Austin and Atlanta and Chicago. And so it's left these areas sort of bereft of any hope, really. And there is correlation. There is direct correlation between how much meth a county consumes and the share of vote for Donald Trump. The more meth, the more votes for Trump. And to me, that's...
Let me just say, you know, when you're looking at high meth usage, that's a sign of desperation, right?
It is. This is not a moral judgment.
This is a sign of desperation. Yeah,
I just wanted to frame lack. That. Yeah, I was gonna make that clear, though.
Sorry.
Because I don't want people to think that I'm... No, but I'm glad you brought it up. I don't want people to think that I'm saying meth users are dumb and therefore they... No, it's desperation. It's lack of hope. There is no hope.
Absolutely.
And there's a sense that American cities, where all the action is, all the culture, all the jobs, all the education, are gated, walled communities that are inaccessible to anybody who can't afford it. And that's huge parts of America, right? I mean, it's rural America. It's expensive to live in an American city. The price of admission is too high for a lot of people. So they are disenchanted and they want to burn the whole system down. And they never participated in the system, right? They didn't vote before. That's why pollsters didn't pick them up. They sure as heck weren't going to answer the phone and answer a pollster, right? So Trump comes in and he's just burning, you know, he's burning shit down. That's what he's doing. International treaties and norms and expectations and traditions. He's just burning it all down. And they're voting for him because he's burning stuff down. I always talk about the Senate race in Georgia, where you had the Republican nominee for the for one of the runoffs, Kelly Loeffler. Her campaign ads in the primary were how she was like Attila the Hun. And I always keep coming to that because what did Attila the Hun did? There's no Hun civilization. There's no Hun arts and culture. Attila just burned and raped his way through Europe. And then he basically extorted the Vatican, the Holy Roman Empire, into bankruptcy. I mean, that was the legacy of Attila the Hun. And that's how she saw herself, to appeal to these Trump voters. Like, we burn stuff down. That's what we do. And then the culmination is almost inevitable. Somehow that wasn't attractive
to enough people in Georgia.
And then, of course, inevitably, that leads to them trying to burn down the frickin' Capitol, right? I mean, this is not... This shouldn't be a surprise, because that's what these Trump Republicans are. And they're not even Republicans. They're not conservatives. They're burned it all down to the ground. People with no hope. So now Trump is out of the picture, and Republicans could have really cut that cancer out, but they didn't.
Let's remember one thing too. And this is a point that we both make, you make often, and I've made before, but I just want to you know, the Republican Party is clinging to Trump because they don't know what else to do. I just don't think they have enough inspired leaders and with enough good ideas. I mean, Adam Kinzinger is actually really interesting, and there's a New York Times profile in him on him today. He's a representative from a Republican representative from Illinois who's just decided he's had it and he's not doing this Trump thing. Besides him, like, I look around and there just isn't anyone who's inspired at all. And so they're clinging to Trump, you know, to try to get this electoral bounce of these new voters that he brought into the fold. But he hasn't proven to bring out these voters in any election where he isn't on the ticket. That means
in the runoff.
Right. That means that not in the runoffs and not in Kansas in 2018 and the gubernatorial race, and not in Louisiana, the gubernatorial race in 2019. Trump wasn't on the ticket, and he begged his voters to come out and vote, and they did not show up and vote. So
they don't care about the Republican Party. They're not Republicans.
So the Republican Party now is now made this bargain that they need Trump that badly, but they're going to have to go through a midterms where normally Democrats would be on the ropes because we have the White House right now, right? But they're going to go through a midterm where they're clinging to Trump for dear life, and Trump's voters, he's not going to be on the ticket, even if he tells his voters he is. And I can't imagine that they're going to turn out in ways that they haven't in the past.
I mean, he can't even communicate to his supporters in a way that he used to be. I mean, Trump is really, his wings are really clipped. And in the runoff, this is an interesting sort of stat. Joe Biden won Georgia by 11,000 votes. Senator Warnock, Raphael Warnock, he won by like 80,000 votes, right? It was a dramatic increase. It wasn't even that close in the end. It was close, but not as close as the general election was. And if you look at where the votes came and didn't come from, the biggest drop off in votes came from Marjorie Taylor Greene's district, which also happens to be it's Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? It's one of the most conservative in the state. And it's probably the most nihilistic district in the state. I mean, if you're gonna vote somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene into office, so it absolutely we saw hints of that drop off in support, and that was still at a time when people were really engaged in a way like it was existential, right? If Republicans lose the Senate, they lose all levers of control in Washington D.C. And 2022, you know, you're going to have some distance and some space, and some of that passion and energy will have dissipated. And yes, we have to make sure that we have it on our side. But I'm actually, there's a big question whether they will do it on their side. And like you alluded to, there is a historical trend where a president's party almost always loses seats in Congress in the first midterm after they're first elected. I know that was a lot of words, but basically the first time Democrats, if you have the White House, the first time your party's up for re-election in the midterm, they lose big. Trump lost control of the House in his first midterm. Obama lost control. Like, you go down the list. The one exception in recent memory is George Bush in 2002, because that was pretty much right after 9/11.
Post 9/11.
And I actually think
he got a big bounce out of that.
Yeah, and I actually think this January 6th insurrection may have the kind of consequences, these sort of reverberations that have like a 9/11 style feeling to 2022, where everybody's still sort of amped up. And if our side's amped up, there's just more of us than them.
Well, and yes, that's true. And perhaps on a final note, one of the biggest things Democrats can do in order to ensure that the base continues to be fired up and engaged is deliver on this initial COVID relief rescue package that Biden and the Democrats appear to be pushing through, hopefully pretty fast and pretty hard. And it looks like it's going to be robust. It's going to be robust. And I think delivering on this, which is one of Biden's biggest campaign promises, particularly in Georgia too, for those final Senate runoffs, but that is really going to set Democrats potentially up for success if he can get a handle on the pandemic, get COVID relief out there to the states and the municipalities and direct checks to individuals, and then start to get the economy to hum back a little bit. If it starts humming I think Democrats will be in very good shape. Knock on wood. I'm going to knock on wood. doing it right now, will be in very good shape for 2022 to potentially not lose seats.
Yeah, so that's a great topic. I think we really are going to want to explore in a future episode, because it's, you know, so much is riding not just on, you know, what's going on now, but 2022 is going to hopefully give us some padding in the Senate if all goes well. There are some real opportunities to pick stuff up, but there's also some real opportunities to lose ground. So a lot's going to be at stake in 2022. It almost feels like every election is the most important election of our lifetime, and they probably are. I mean, that's the sort of situation. They are, because everyone is existential, given who the enemy, who the opposition is. So I want to thank Eli Mistal for joining us and talking about impeachment and the chances of any kind of justice for Donald Trump. We weren't able to talk to Sarah Longwell, but we're going to make sure to reschedule and have that conversation, because I think that's an important one. So thank you, everybody, for listening, for joining us. Thank you to Walter Einenkel for producing the show. And we will see you all next week. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, give us a rating wherever you get your podcast. You can always talk to us at dailycoast.com or on Twitter @dailycoast. See you next week.